Relidir Trallus.
This time, Jaina spoke each word with brilliant individual clarity, making it impossible to misunderstand her. I said, drop the shields. Over.
Negative on that. Negative.
The groundside officer's voice sounded young and a little panicky.
The enemy is less than 3 minutes away and descending rapidly.
Goodness, Jaina said. At 2 seconds to drop the shields and 2 to raise them again after we're outside, that gives you what? More than 2.5 minutes to dither and still be safe? Drop the carking shields and let us out!
She pounded a portion of her control boards, unoccupied by buttons or readouts, with her fist. Her squadron circled above downtown Relidir, confined by the energy shields defending that portion of the city. Other starfighters were buzzing beneath her, but none of the other squadrons seemed as anxious to leave the shielded area.
Orders are for all squadrons to stay close at hand and defend the center,
the anonymous officer said.
So you're to stay put.
Star system MZX32905 near Bemeel.
The three Jedi and Brisha rode the turbolift back down to the bottom level of the habitat.
That's something you could have mentioned from the beginning, Nalani said. There's a Sith in the basement. Any other home in the galaxy, that'd be the first thing out of someone's mouth.
What's his name? Ben asked.
Brisha shrugged.
He hasn't revealed himself to me, and so certainly hasn't told me his name.
Then she grinned, suddenly playful.
Darth something, I expect.
The turbolift thudded to a halt at the habitat's bottom level, the level by which they had originally entered the structure. Brisha led them from there through a side door into a hexagonal room, dominated by a tube. Tilted at a 45-degree angle, it was a cylinder of transparisteel, marked by a pair of metal rails. The tube was just under 2 meters in diameter, and suspended above it on a metal brace was a sort of metal-wheeled cart. The cart had 6 seats up front, a copious cargo area in the middle, and a backward-facing set of 6 seats at the very end. Ben peered at the tube. It led down past the floor into darkness, but as he watched, the interior surface of the tube began to glow.
This is going to be fun, he said matter-of-factly.
Relidir Trallus.
Incoming fighters,
Grey One called out.
Coming in from orbit north-northwest.
Sile could see them on her sensors, big fuzzy blips resolving into 2 or 3 squadrons of starfighters and at least 2 larger targets.
We'll do this as a simple strafe,
Grey One continued.
Wait until they commit to a course, then follow me in. Punch a big hole through everything you see.
Star system MZX32905 near Bemeel.
The rail car plunged through blackness, and Ben felt his stomach rise into his throat, then break free and float, like a ghost away from his body. In the first moments, there was almost no wind in his face. Then, suddenly, the air currents increased and became cold. He guessed that they were now out of the tube and hurtling down through the caverns Brishan had spoken of. Ben could feel the concentrated dark side energy that waited below. It didn't feel so much malicious as merely ominous. Less an enemy threatening death than a somber realist reminding him that death was what he ultimately faced. The rail noises, suddenly close and echoing, then distant and quieter, told Ben that they'd passed through a narrow region and emerged into another cavern. He was grabbed by the collar from behind and yanked up out of his seat. He found himself floating, drifting through the darkness, perhaps hurtling at dangerous speeds towards sharp rock formations, and was so startled by the sudden transition that he didn't even cry out.
Relidir Trallus.
Incoming starfighters!
The voice of the leader of one of the 2 squadrons now escorting the Shriek bombers crackled in Han's ears.
You 2 stay put. We'll handle them.
One of the fighter squadrons broke away from the formation. The other stayed in array around the Shriek bombers. On the sensor board, Han could see the dozen attack fighters head out southeastward against the incoming flight of 6 starfighters, unknown type. Unknown type. Han frowned over that. He liked surprises, but only when he was springing them on someone else. The outbound attack fighter formation neared the enemy formation, and their lines blurred for a moment. Then, suddenly, there were 9 fighters instead of 12.
frantically turning in the wake of the unknown enemy. The enemy still numbered six.
Not good, Han said.
Lasers to power,
Wedge answered. Han checked his weapons board. The lasers in his topside turret were charged and ready to go. Half the remaining attack fighter escort broke away from the shrieks and turned toward the incoming fighters, forming a defensive screen. Red laser flashes, missed shots by the incoming enemy, flashed by laterally ahead of Han's viewport. Suddenly, the six attack fighters that had just turned away became four on the sensors, and Han's targeting alarm shrieked with the news that one of the enemy had a weapons lock on him. Han kicked his thruster, then fired repulsors, tactics to vary his speed and throw off the aim of his enemies. He spun so that his shriek was presented edge-on to the enemy, dropped his own targeting brackets over the foremost enemy, and fired. The two informative sensor board responded with an almost comical ding, indicating that he'd hit his target. Six enemy starfighters, oversized silver balls trailing narrowing twin thruster pods, flashed by from right to left, pursued by a flight of Carillion attack fighters. In the distance to the left, the enemy craft began a slow turn back toward the fight. Han blinked.
What the fear feck are those?
Cnar 11 class starfighters, Wedge said. They're out of prototype and in limited production.
Great. I hit mine with a good quad-length punch and it didn't even shudder.
Yeah, they're supposed to be like shooting solid metal ball bearings.
Wedge switched over to the squadron frequency.
Nebula flight. Panthers are making our break. Good luck. Panther 1, this is Nebula Leader. Blow something up for us.
Battle carrier Dodona above Tralos.
The starfighter control chamber was an exercise in controlled chaos. A sight familiar to Leia, who'd helped coordinate many starfighter skirmishes, starting with the Battle of Yavin. Aboard Dodona, they had bells and whistles she'd never enjoyed in the control room at Yavin. The entire battle was being reproduced via holograms over their heads. The skirmishes not exactly to scale, but with each individual starfighter or vessel shown in a wireframe form, color-coded to whichever side the fighting vehicle represented. The GA forces were blue, Corellian forces red. Unknowns, including several vehicles, probably civilian, above Reladir and heading away from the endangered city, in yellow. Equipped with a specialized datapad handed to her by the chamber's coordinator, a black-furred Bothan colonel by the name of Moyan, Leia could gather all sorts of data about the various forces. By pointing the datapad at any vessel or vehicle and tagging it with a beam of light from the device, she could display information about the target on the datapad screen. As several of the coordinators in the chamber were doing, she pointed at one of the mystery bombers descending on Reladir and sampled its information. Friend or foe? Enemy. Class? CECYT variant. Unknown. Estimation? Bomber. Pilot? Unknown. Information on the other shriek was identical. Leia spoke quietly into her datapad, allowing its speech-to-text translator to add a notation to the data on the bomber. Believed damaged, as it's turning away from GA targets. Recommend concentration on fighter escort. She tapped the screen to send that datum to Dodona's database. A flash of guilt washed across her. She was pretending to be helping the GA forces, and instead, she was protecting her husband as he bombed them.
Coruscant.
His head filled with a baffling mix of emotions and images, Luke sat up in bed. He spared Mara a glance, saw that she was still asleep, and rose. So pounded was he by sensations reaching him through the Force that it was actually difficult to think. Cautious, he opened himself to them, trying to sort them out. Betraying trust. To act is to betray. Not to act is to betray. A Minok, its eyes glittering with unusual intelligence, stared at him from the distance of centuries. The Sith are not what you think. Leia, her features smoothed by grief so great it could not be expressed, fell forward, folding over as she did. Dark, dark. I will not be afraid of the dark. Han, regret on his face, a vibroblade in his hand, lunged forward and slammed the blade between the ribs of a pretty young woman with dark hair. I loved you in my own way. I would have repaired the harm I did you. His attention was drawn back to Mara. Now her eyes were open. staring sightlessly upward, her body cut and butchered, the edges still black and steaming by a lightsaber blade. Luke shook his head and exerted himself through the Force, willing the visions, the voices, away. They faded, leaving him in the dark, with his wife asleep and unharmed. He took his lightsaber from the nightstand and moved out into the hallway. He didn't want his perturbation to awaken Mara. Something was happening. Events at distant points of the galaxy, and even of time, were focusing toward him and those he loved. On the cold stone floor outside his chambers, he sat cross-legged and tried to sink into a meditative state. A state to give him real knowledge. A state to grant him peace.
Star System MZX32905 near Bemeel.
Ben took his lightsaber into his hands and thumbed it on. Its snap hiss was less welcome than the blue light it emitted. Suddenly, he could see all around him, even if dimly. He floated through open space, but ahead of him, 30 or 40 meters, was a broken stone wall, and he floated toward it at a rate of several meters a second.
Two-handed form, Nalani said behind him. Makes it rather hard to hold on to stone walls.
Ben twisted to look behind him. Nalani floated there. He turned back to face the onrushing wall.
Did you pull me out of the rail car?
Don't be stupid.
I'm not stupid. Don't be snide.
Sorry, I'm upset.
Her tone changed.
Nalani to Jason, come in.
As the stone wall came nearer, Ben spotted a feature on it he thought he could grab. A rocky projection that narrowed to a needle-like point. He held his lightsaber back into one side with his right hand, extended his left, and as he reached the projection, he grabbed it, swinging his feet ahead of him to sustain the minimal shock of impact. A moment later, Nalani hit a few meters down, her fingers slipping into a crack in the stone, her hips and shoulders taking the impact.
So who did it?
Ben persisted.
The Sith?
We have company.
Ben looked down at her, then around, then up. Above him, 10 meters up, a pair of eyes stared down at him. They glowed blue in the reflected light of his lightsaber blade. They were not human eyes, but slitted and triangular. Beyond them were more, hundreds of pairs of eyes, cool and unblinking. Ben shook his head.
Not good, he said.
Drop,
Nalani said.
Yeah.
Ben released his hold on the projection and drifted downward. Above, the eyes began to descend, staying at their respective distance from the gleam of his lightsaber, but definitely following. The rail car slowed to a halt, curving around in a circle. Brisha and Jason were in a well-lit chamber, large enough to house a good-sized transport, but the only thing present was the end of the rail line. Jason didn't bother with the scenery. He stared at Brisha.
Why did you do that?
He asked. She gave him an innocent stare.
Do what?
Shove Ben and Nalani out of the car. Did you think I couldn't feel your pulse of Force energy?
I suspected you could.
She stood and stepped out of the car.
I separated them from us for their own good.
She turned toward a shadowy corner of the chamber, a place where a huge rounded outcropping came within meters of the curved section of rail. From around that outcropping walked a man. He was tall, slender, garbed in a traveler's robe of black and dark gold. It was styled like a Jedi's, but made of expensive silks. A lightsaber, its hilt also in black and gold, swung at his belt. His hands were gloved, and his face was in the deep shadow cast by the hood of his cloak, though his eyes, a liquid luminous orange gold, glowed from within that darkness. He came to a stop just at the edge of that outcropping, several meters from Jason and Brisha.
So, you're the Sith,
Jason said. The dark figure bowed. Jason gave him a scornful look.
How am I supposed to take you seriously? You're not even here.
The hooded man's voice came back as a whisper.
What do you mean?
I mean you walked as if you were in Coruscant standard gravity instead of a tiny fraction of it. You're an illusion.
Yes, I'm an illusion, but I'm also here, right here.
Care to explain that?
No.
Ah. Jason thumbed his lightsaber into life.
Well, I suppose I should be cutting you in half now.
I am a master. You are a Jedi Knight. Do you know what that means?
That I can't win? Jason punctuated his question with a mocking laugh.
No, that you must go through my subordinates to get to me, allowing me to test you, to evaluate you. That's tradition, you know.
If you say so. The reflection of the Sith's gold orange eyes disappeared, and then the Sith himself vanished, ghost-like. But there was a sound from beyond where he had stood, a slight scrape, and another figure moved forward into view. This one walked, as the Sith had, in a fashion appropriate for a standard gravity environment, and stepped out to stand where the Sith had stood. He was not tall, but he was well-muscled and agile. He wore black pants, tunic, boots, and gloves, and held an unlit lightsaber. His features were those of Luke Skywalker, but rakishly bearded and twisted into a grin that was all malice and scorn. Not nice, Jason said. Nalani reached the bottom of the cavern first, taking the minor shock of impact on bent legs and being propelled a few meters back up into the air. On his way down, Ben passed her on her upward bounce, but he had eyes only for the creatures clustered on the stone wall above. He hit stony floor, bounced upward a few meters, past Nalani again as she descended. Soon enough, both had their feet none too firmly on the surface beneath. Now Ben could hear rustling, hissing that sounded like muffled, sibilant speech from above, from hundreds of sources above.
They're going to swarm us, Nalani said.
As if her words were a cue, a form of permission, the eyes above suddenly descended en masse, pouring downward as if carried by a waterfall. Nalani's lightsaber snapped into life. The first wave of descending creatures broke before it reached the Jedi, splitting into two streams, each headed a different direction parallel to the stone face. But two of the creatures did not veer away. One came at Ben, one at Nalani. Ben pushed off straight toward his attacker. Ben swung, felt his blade cut into skin and meat, and was propelled back down by the impact as the two halves of the beast hurtled lifelessly past him, one to either side. The soles of his feet hit stone again. The two Minok halves were partly embedded in the stone, and as he glanced at them, they slipped beneath the stone's surface like two halves of a boat sinking. They left nothing behind. No blood. Nothing.
They're not real, Ben said. Projections of the Force,
Nalani answered from behind. Heedless of the swarms of Minoks overhead, Ben spun, the motion bouncing him a couple of meters up. Nalani was gone. In her place stood Mara Skywalker. Her eyes glittered with anger, and her body language suggested punishment to come. Her lightsaber in her hand was unlit. Ben floated back to the ground.
You're not my mother, he said.
Good, she said. Then it won't be a family crime to cut you down.
She ignited the lightsaber, and its blade glowed red.
Relidir Tralis.
Han and Wedge lined up on the boulevard that would carry them straight to the Turkuri housing complex. Han, in the lead by a handful of meters, brought his shriek down almost to the deck. Up ahead, a pair of starfighters crested a row of skyscrapers and began a plummet towards street level, turning towards the shrieks. Worse yet, a new warble in the sensor alarm indicated the presence of an enemy or enemies coming up from behind. Han glanced at the board again. The new opponent was one of the Alephs, flying like the shrieks at almost street level and roaring up in their wakes. Han brought his turret lasers to bear on the E-wings. His targeting brackets chittered around the foremost E-wing, and he fired. The shot missed. Incoming laser fire, red streaks flashed by beneath Han's bow. Then the datapad glued to his control board beeped. Han bit back a curse at the timing of this distraction and glanced at the screen. A left pursuer is Wedge's daughter. A cold current seemed to cut through Han's stomach as he read the words. They had no way to communicate with the girl, to warn her off. Han didn't want to kill Wedge's daughter, even to fire upon her. But it would be worse if Wedge did. Worse still if she killed Wedge. Worse for Corellia and their mission.
Coruscant.
Luke felt a presence, the arrival of someone strong in the Force. He opened his eyes. Hovering over the floor in front of him, meters from him, was his nephew and one-time prize pupil, Jason, lightsaber lit in his hand. Except it was not truly Jason. Whoever it was reeked of dark side energy, and his stare promised only malevolence.
Not nice,
the false Jason said. Luke lit his lightsaber. The knot Jason struck, a fast, powerful lateral blow that Luke met with little effort, without conscious thought. Then Luke heard the humming and chattering of lightsabers in conflict. The muffled noise was coming from his own quarters. Mara rose, throwing her covers off in a move designed to whirl them over attackers and give her a moment to collect herself. As she came up on her feet, she reached out and pulled through the Force, and was rewarded with the comforting weight of her lightsaber hilt thumping into her hand. The room was lit in hues of red by the lightsaber blade hovering in the middle of the room. It was held by a small, misshapen form whose feet were well off the ground. It was a boy, maybe 13 years of age. Its features resembled Ben's, but were twisted in anger. An anger that looked like it had years of abuse, jealousy, and rage behind it. The boy drifted gently down to the floor.
You're not my mother,
he said. Good, Mara answered. Then it won't be a family crime to cut you down.
Reladir Tralus.
Han winced as his pursuer's lasers hammered at his stern. He diverted extra power from his bow shields to reinforce the stern, a dangerous gambit. If laser fire from the oncoming E-Wings missed Wedge, it could accidentally smack into Han's bow and ruin his day. Ruin the rest of his life, in fact. But Wedge had managed to vape one of the E-Wings with laser fire of his own, and the other had peeled off. It was now circling around to drop in behind the Aleph and reinforce it. Not that the Aleph needed much reinforcing. Wedge's little girl was good at her job. She had dropped so low and come in so close behind the Shriek that Han's turret lasers couldn't depress enough to attack her, and meanwhile she could chew up his thrusters with impunity. If only he had a stern-mounted weapon. Wait a minute, he did. He had a bomb bay full of spotter droids. His fingers flew over his weapons console, punching in a set of unusual commands. He hit the execute button. Two of his spotter droids would now be sliding into the bomb drop slots.
Got him, got him, got him!
Zweb, Sile's Sulliston co-pilot, called. His lasers continued to chew the tail end of the mystery bomber to pieces.
Something's going on with the underside, Sile said. She wanted to drop another meter, but suspected she'd bottom out on the street. Even so, she could already see something changing on the bomber's underside. Panels sliding aside, something moving into position there on either side of the bomber's center line. Does that look like feet to you?
Zweb ducked his oversized Sulliston head as far as he could.
Yes, feet.
What the blazes?
Those feet, and the humanoid bodies they were attached to, suddenly plummeted from the bomber. Sile had a glimpse of two flailing bodies, like dull silver protocol droids with oddly shaped rifles, as they dropped into her path and hurtled toward her bow. Sile couldn't help it. Her hand twitched on the control yoke, an instinctive attempt to avoid the collision. Then came the impact. One droid hitting each of the Aleph's forward viewports. The one hitting the starboard viewport shattered. The one hitting the port viewport directly in front of her didn't shatter. It held on, its face right there in the center of the transperisteel, and it offered Sile what seemed to her like a reproachful expression. In that moment, she recognized it as a type of standard spotter droid. Then Sile's involuntary sideslip carried the Aleph far enough that its starboard laser turret began scraping along the building fronts there, tearing marquees and signs off edifices. She jerked the yoke to port, trying to free herself from that deadly friction before it spun her right into a building, and felt the shuddering end as she broke free. No time to think. Now she was traversing toward the buildings to port, and the droid was still looking at her. Gently, she corrected her course, noting absently that the bomber had gained scores of meters on her.
Great flying, Grey Four.
The voice was male, unknown to her, the accent Coruscanti. Sile couldn't risk taking her attention from the avenue ahead long enough to consult her comm board. Who's that?
You've got Axe 3 as your wing.
Axe, you tear him up while I get my life in order here.
Will do. Be advised, I'm picking up a huge pursuit squadron on our tail, and it's not ours.
Zweb unbuckled and leaned forward. With his fist, he pounded on the inside of Sile's viewport. The droid outside turned its head to look at him, and this change in its aerodynamics was apparently enough. The Aleph lurched and the droid was suddenly gone, whipped away by the altered airflow across its surface. Thanks, Sile said.
No problem.
Sile gave the control yoke a tentative adjustment. The Aleph moved back into the center of the avenue, responding correctly. Only then did she check her sensor board. It showed the E-Wing high overhead, and in her peripheral vision, she could see red lasers from the fast-moving starfighter hammering the bomber ahead of her. Far behind was an immense cloud of vessels moving up at tremendous speed. It would be on her in 30 seconds or less, and the sensor board still couldn't tell her what the individual vehicles in it were. And up ahead, beyond the first of the bombers, but too close, was the end of the avenue, a huge, newly constructed housing building. Sile looked up and her eyes widened. If she pulled up into a climb right now, she might be able to clear the tops of the surrounding buildings. But the foremost bomber was so close to the building, there was no way it could avoid a collision. She saw that bomber fire missiles ahead and downward. The street just before the big building erupted in smoke and dust. And in the split second before it was swallowed by the dust cloud, she would have sworn she saw the bomber dive toward the street. The second bomber, the one she'd been harassing, lost altitude. Its pilot had no distractions. Axe 3 was now climbing away from the engagement, ascending to safety. Sile became aware that Zweb was screaming at her, something about climbing, about continuing to live. She ignored him and glanced at her sensors. The zone where the missiles had hit was still only partly realized on the screen, but it was a big hole, and the first bomber was gone. It wasn't hitting the building, wasn't veering right or left in a futile attempt to get free of the surrounding construction. It was just gone, into the hole. Sile aimed her Aleph along the second bomber's wake. The second bomber disappeared into the smoke cloud. On the sensor board, it dropped into the hole in the street. As Sile reached that point, she slammed downward on the yoke, compressing it for a fraction of a second. Her top-mounted vents fired, jolting the Aleph downward. It didn't hit anything. Through the viewports, there was only smoke and darkness. On the sensor screen was the tail end of that chewed-up bomber blasting forward between banks of heavy-looking columns. There was debris, heavy dust and particulate matter ahead of it. It rose toward the debris. As her Aleph reached the point where the bomber began its rise, she jerked upward on her yoke, and the bottom-mounted vents fired. She added some repulsor lift kick. The Aleph jolted upward, and suddenly, they were in sunlight again. Green parklands and the shimmering dome of a military energy shield lay ahead. The first bomber was circling to port around the shield, the second bomber to starboard. Both were dropping their bomb loads, spotter droids floating to the ground. Their descent slowed by the sort of short-use repulsor lift plates used by airdrop commando troops. Above circled squadrons of X-Wings, Eta-5 interceptors, E-Wings, the complete ground complement of the Relidir garrison. Zweb was shrieking something about great flying and having children in holodramas. Sile ignored him. Something was adding up in her head. Cold numbers and facts. She slammed on reverse thrusters to slow the Aleph, jerking Zweb forward in his seat, and switched her comm board over to the general fleet frequency. This is Gray 4 to all GA forces. Incoming enemy squadrons traveling east to west toward Relidir Central are missiles, and they have an unobstructed path to the interior shield. Be ready. She switched back to squadron frequency. Zweb, fire missiles. Bring that building down. Hit the base first.
What?
That's an order. Bring that building down, from ground level up.
Zweb's hands reached for his weapons controls.
Coruscant.
The not Jason came at Luke again and again, making prodigious leaps, bounding from wall to wall, from ceiling to floor, as if immune to gravity. With each pass, he hurled 1, 2, 3 lightsaber blows at Luke, striking again and again, until thrown back by the impacts, he was too far away to engage. Luke countered every blow and pitched attacks of his own. He felt the skin of his left forearm pucker a little from the heat of a near hit, saw the not Jason's robes catch fire just under the right armpit from an especially close thrust of Luke's. But not Jason patted the flames out and merely grinned at him. Not Jason seized a ceiling glow rod fixture and hung there as though his weight were nothing.
You're just about as good as my true master,
Not Jason said. Luke gave him a quizzical look. And who is that?
You know,
Not Jason said.
By the way, you'd look good with a beard.
Star system MZX32905 near Bemeel.
Jason seized a rock outcropping and held it, keeping him from dropping once more toward the man with the face of Luke Skywalker. You're just about as good as my true master, Jason said. The bearded man gave him a mocking look.
And who is that?
You know, Jason said. By the way, you look good with a beard.
You think so?
His opponent stroked his facial hair.
Well, I'm not sure what our disagreement is, but perhaps it could be settled by talking.
Jason considered that. I try not to negotiate with phantoms, with things that don't exist. Better to just cut them in half and watch them disappear. Jason kicked off from the wall and flew forward again. He knew that this solidly planted, gravitationally advantaged Luke had adapted to Jason's low-gravity tactics, so he altered them. The instant he touched down before the false Luke, he planted his feet and used the force to brace him there, then threw a flurry of hard blows. It was no use. The false Luke adapted instantly to his change in tactics, reverting to a softer, defensive style, turning away each of Jason's all-out attacks, and he did so, grinning, silently mocking. The false Luke, instead of countering Jason's fifth blow in sequence, sidestepped it, luring Jason forward and off balance. Luke's counterstrike whipped around and down toward Jason's unprotected back. Enough, Brisha said, and the false Luke vanished. Jason, straightening, looked up at Brisha. Who was that, really? She shrugged.
A combination of real Luke Skywalker and the dark side energy of this place. A combination that would have beaten you, since you weren't utilizing the same energy, the resources available to you.
She still held on to one of the rails, sagged against it, actually. She was perspiring. You've been using a lot of energy yourself, Jason said. He switched his lightsaber off. She nodded.
Coordinating the attacks of several Force Phantoms at once. Very tiring. Try it sometime.
So you admit that you're behind this assault on me?
Oh, it was no assault. Just a test. If it had been an assault, I would have let the Luke Phantom kill you, don't you think?
Jason frowned. Her words had the ring of truth to them. I think it's time for you to tell me your whole story.
Of course.
She pushed off from the rail and floated toward the stone outcropping where the false Luke had originally arrived. She bounced lightly past Jason and beckoned for him to follow.
All the answers are this way.
He followed.
Reladir Tralis.
Han grinned as he completed his circuit around the shield-protected center of the performing arts. His spotter droids were raining down on the ground, sustaining but ignoring small arms fire from the GA ground crews and infantry. And already, his board was lighting up with the data the droids were feeding to the Corellian Operations Headquarters. On the wireframe representation of the local area, the top of the shield was a hotspot where numerous droids had their laser sighting rifles trained. Above, many of the starfighters trapped within the outer range of the shields were also being targeted. Han's and Wedge's shrieks were on the spotter droid's matrix as well, as non-targets. In theory, the shrieks were safe from the missile barrage. In theory. Han didn't rely much on theory. He'd prefer to have some buildings between him and the incoming missiles. There was something wrong. Ahead, as he completed his circuit, was an Aleph where no Aleph should be. Han's eyebrows shot up. This had to be the Aleph that had pursued them on the approach boulevard, Sile Antilles' craft. And now it was slowing, turning toward the Turcury building. Alarm bells went off in Han's head. If he were in Sile's position, he would know that the missiles were roaring up behind. He would be figuring out how to stop them before they got here. And that meant dropping a rack full of missiles into the Turcury building. That's what Sile was doing, and he had to stop her. He switched his weapons board over to missile fire and dropped his targeting brackets over the Aleph, and hesitated.
This was Wedge's little girl. He couldn't kill her. He pushed the weapons control forward. The targeting brackets clicked off the Aleph and dropped to the ground several meters beneath the hovering starfighter. Han fired. Sile watched impassively as Webb targeted the building just above the huge hole in the ground that the Aleph and the two bombers had emerged through. He seemed to be moving in slow motion. Everything seemed to be in slow motion. The astromech beeped an alarm. A targeting lock on the Aleph. Sile frowned. She kept her hands steady on the controls. A sideways jerk might cause Webb to miss his target, and she couldn't afford for that to happen. Besides, the incoming fire was probably a laser barrage by an opportunistic X-Wing pilot, and she could survive a few seconds of that. The world exploded around her. The Aleph was kicked as if by a rancor the size of a skyscraper. The Aleph disappeared in the dust and debris cloud of Han's concussion missile, and for a moment, Han thought the starfighter had gone to confetti from the force of the blast. But the Aleph leapt up out of the cloud, spinning out of control. The pilot was attempting to regain control. The thrusters, as they began to be pointed toward the ground, fired and continued firing until they were horizontal. The explosion blackened starfighter wobbled as it resumed powered flight, but it was under control. A cloud of what looked like flaming insects roiled up from the crater at the foot of the Turkery building. Missiles, in their hundreds. Most headed skyward. Their flight plan would have them turn just under the dome of the outer shield and dive toward the inner, hitting two or three spots, overwhelming them with explosive power, allowing the subsequent missiles to rain down on the center of the performing arts. Others would target the starfighters overhead and the larger ships still on the ground. The majority of the missiles reached the summit of their arcs and turned back toward the ground. Some didn't. A few hit targets in the air. Starfighters circling above the Galactic Alliance beachhead. Pilots waiting to get into the fight. Pilots who weren't fast enough to elude missile fire or eject in anticipation of the impact. The other missiles completed their turns and roared downward, concentrating into three streams. The leading missiles of those streams hit the glowing dome of the GA shield, matching their explosive energy against its coherent force. The first several lost the match. The shields were too strong, but the missiles kept coming, each one adding new explosive power to the equation. The shield shivered. Then, in 1/1000th of a second, it happened. The complex fabric of the shield unraveled at one point, and the next missile entered the empty space where it had been. It did not detonate. The computer at the heart of its guidance system relayed its new position, meters beyond what had been designated the shield limits, to the other missiles in the flight. And those that could still maneuver to position themselves along its path began to do so. That missile was halfway down to the crown-like top of the Center for Performing Arts when the next spot atop the curved surface of the shield gave way. More missiles flashed through the widening gap. Then a lance of fire shot down from the position of the shields and hit the roof of the Center for the Performing Arts. Then the shields gave way, and the flame and debris behind them spilled out in all directions.
Coruscant.
I was fighting a simulacrum of Jason, Luke said. He paced through his bedchamber, looking in the closet and then under the bed, as if more enemies were likely to be found there. Mine was a twisted form of Ben, Mara said. Rather cruel of an enemy to try to kill you in the image of your own son. Luke, on his knees by the bed, looked up at her. Why didn't they send a Ben against each of us? Wouldn't that improve the odds that one of us would hesitate, at least in theory? Mara shrugged. What did this? Luke rose. A dark side force user of some sort. Or a group of them. Something new? I don't know. He moved back to the closet, pulled out his off-white pants and tunic. Something's happening out there. Where Leia is, maybe where Jason and Ben are. I'm going to get on the comm and see what I can find out.
Star system MZX-32905 near Bemeel.
Around the rock outcropping, Jason came face to face with another rock, a boulder of black stone. Its surface shiny and smooth. It was unlike any other surface he'd seen while in these caverns, and it reeked of dark side energy. A door, he said.
Beside him, Brisha nodded. Jason reached out to explore the barrier with his force-attuned senses. The stone seemed to be resting on a pivot of pure energy. The slightest exertion would swing it to one side. But the exertion had to be made through the force, through the dark side of the force. He shrugged, gestured, exerted himself minimally along dark paths. The boulder swung obediently to one side. There was darkness beyond. Brisha moved into the darkness, and Jason followed her. Just past the boulder entrance, on the similarly smooth stone to the left, a set of sturdy metal levers and controls was revealed, and she flipped several of those switches from the bottom to the top position. In the distance, a light came on, bright, golden light, cheerful and warm in hue, revealing that Jason and Brisha stood in an irregular stone corridor, triangular, wide at the base, coming to a point a couple of meters above their heads. The corridor widened a few meters before them, and the cavern beyond was being illuminated by the new light. They moved out from the corridor and into the open cavern, and Jason blinked at what he saw. The cavern was open, its walls slightly irregular, but still of the same dark, smooth material as the boulder door. Jason's eye was drawn to the building that occupied the cavern's center. It was a mansion, 5 stories of stony construction, and it did not seem in the least ominous. At each corner of the building was a tower. The chamber at its summit, roofed but open to the sides, and figures moved there in various windows of the building. In one tower window, a figure painted. In another, one played an oversized harp. In one of the lower windows, a figure juggled 3 glowing yellow balls. At the center of the 5th floor, a huge mechanism, all gigantic gears and levers, operated, its whole purpose apparently being to drive a single dial on the face of the building. It turned at a rate of 2 or 3 times a minute, carefully watched by a figure who stood on the 5th floor ledge in front of it. The moving figures were all protocol droids, and gaily painted, one red, one forest green, one gold. The machine tender was a pastel blue, and it was all suffused with dark side energy. "This," Jason said, "is insane."
"Not really."
Brisha walked toward the building with him.
"Darth Vectivus enjoyed the architecture of Naboo and incorporated some of its building materials into his home away from home. Other architectural elements are from other worlds."
They reached the steps to the main doors. As they began climbing, those doors swung open for them. "All right," Jason said. "No more delays. The truth." He reached the top of the stairs and moved into the hallway. He felt a little off balance. The dissonance between the energies he felt and the cheerful surroundings bothered him.
"The truth is, I trained to be a Sith. I was trained by your grandfather, Darth Vader. My true name is Shira Bree."
Jason blinked at her. "But you're better known as Lumaya." In his mind, he called up holographic images he'd been shown of the famous monster, the woman whose lower face was always concealed behind a tight-fitting veil, who always wore a triangular headdress, who carried a unique weapon, a light whip, as destructive as a lightsaber, but pliant and with greater reach. There was no place for this woman to carry one in the jumpsuit she now wore, but he did not deceive himself that she was unarmed.
"I was raised on Coruscant, tapped for Imperial service, and when Luke Skywalker became a hero of the rebels, I joined them."
"To kill him?"
"No, to do worse, to discredit him. A ruined hero is much more devastating than a dead one. Once he was ruined as a rebel, I planned to draw him over to the Imperial side. But during a starfighter battle, he relied on the Force instead of transponder data to differentiate friend from foe and shot me down."
"I'd heard that."
"I lived, but it cost me. Cost me more than half of my body, in fact. My limbs, some of my organs."
She looked down at herself.
"Cybernetic replacements. And that's when Darth Vader took special interest in me. Perhaps because of our similarities. Would you like to see the rest of the house?"
"No, we can do the house tour after your explanation, after I retrieve Ben and Nalani."
"So, Palpatine and Vader both die, and you have no chance to be educated enough to become the mistress of the Sith." "Oh, there you're wrong, Jason. Lumaya shook her head as if chiding him for his ignorance. I never had any chance to become mistress of the Sith, no matter how much I learned.
Why not?
The Force is the energy of the living. You interact with it. It's eddies and flows with your own living body. It's all right to have a mechanical part or two, an implant, a replacement foot. But for true mastery in the Force, light side or dark side, you have to be mostly organic. I'm not. And so the greatest, the most significant powers, I can never learn.
Jason frowned. Wait, that means that Darth Vader could never have become the Lord of the Sith, a true master.
That's correct. I'm not sure he ever understood that.
So that's what the trap is.
Hmm?
Lumaya looked surprised. You didn't lure me here to kill me. You lured me here to persuade me to take up the path of the Sith.
Yes.
Because I have all my body parts. She grinned at him.
Not exactly. Because it's you. All the portents, all the convergences flowing into the future say so. Particularly since you've already received quite a lot of Sith training.
Explain that.
In a minute. What was I saying? Oh, yes. I'm not trying to turn you into a Palpatine. He was, as you say, a psychopath. Destructive, uncaring, manipulative. He chose the dark side to achieve his ends, but was weak and confused enough to be twisted by the dark side. Unlike your Uncle Luke, you haven't been twisted by the light side. So I'm certain you can resist the temptations of the dark.
I've heard enough!
The voice was Nalani's, and there she was, striding in through the front doors, her unlit lightsaber in her hand.
As I'm sure you have, Jason.
Where's Ben? Jason asked. Nalani shook her head.
We were separated. You were never together,
Lumaya said.
When you were talking to Ben, and he to you, you were actually hundreds of meters apart, talking to Force phantoms of each other.
Jason turned to Lumaya.
Where's Ben?
He repeated.
Unconscious, not hurt. He'll wake up a little sore.
Lumaya shrugged.
If I were the monster you thought I was, he'd be dead, Jason. The son of the man who shot me down and destroyed my body. Think about it.
Think about this, Jason said. Brisha, Shira, Lumaya, whatever you choose to call yourself, there are still outstanding charges against you for crimes committed back when you were an Imperial. Whatever you are now, you have to face those.
Perhaps.
Lumaya suddenly looked tired, dispirited.
I just wish you weren't taking me into custody from your own fear. That's sad.
Fear? Jason frowned at her. I have nothing to fear.
You're afraid that my words might be true,
Lumaya said.
That the dark side doesn't corrupt in and of itself. That you're destined to become the next Sith Lord. The first Sith Lord to be active in decades. The first one in centuries, with the strength to use the Sith techniques to help others. Because if it is true, you have to make a decision. Choosing between your life as it is, comfortable but almost purposeless, and life as you know it should be.
Nalani's lightsaber snap hissed into life.
I think you need to shut up.
There's no need for that, Jason said. No need unless she resists. Lumaya smiled.
There's no worry. Nalani would never attack me unless I resisted. She's a very good girl. A sweet doctrinal Jedi. This sweet doctrinal Jedi is about to kick your teeth in,
Nalani said.
Jason, I can feel you wavering.
I'm not wavering. I'm just curious about her arguments. There is merit to some of them.
Like any Darksider, she mixes truth with lies until you can't separate them.
Jason ignored Nalani. Lumaya, you present me this house as though it constitutes proof that Darth Vectivus was a nice man despite his Darkside training. Well, that doesn't wash. Anyone can commission the building of a pretty house. He fixed her with a look he intended as amused condescension. The Darkside corrupts. The Sith are inevitably drawn to evil.
I can give you proof of one who wasn't,
Lumaya said. Nalani glared at Jason.
Don't listen.
Jason shrugged. Go ahead. Lumaya looked dispirited.
Should I? Why bother? With sweet Nalani whispering in your ear, you're certain to automatically disbelieve every word I say.
Then the forlorn look left her face, replaced by a slight smile.
After all, everything I tell you is a lie.
Jason cleared his throat. An interesting turn of phrase, he said.
Not an accidental one.
Lumaya turned to look at Nalani.
Turn that thing off, dear. You'll run the battery down.
Nalani didn't budge. Her blade remained lit and glowing.
Jason, something's wrong. What is she saying?
She's saying nothing.
Then I'll give you a name,
Lumaya said.
Vergere. She said that, didn't she? When she was training you to be a Sith.
She was training me to survive, Jason said. He thought of his one-time mentor, the diminutive bird-like alien who'd been born in this galaxy but had lived for years among the Yuuzhan Vong, accompanying them back when they swept into the galaxy on their mission of conquest and destruction.
Yes,
Lumaya said.
To survive. Survival is a Sith trait. Jedi train themselves for self-sacrifice, for union with the Force, and they can afford to be suicidal because there are so many of them. Sith trained to survive.
Now you're making things up, Jason said. Nalani, keep her here while I go find Ben. Lumaya shook her head.
You don't want Ben to be here. Someone's about to die. It might be you. It might be Nalani. And it might be me. Bring Ben here, and it might be him.
Frowning, Jason cast out his senses like a net, sampling the present and the future. Pathways led in all directions, but in each of them, one of the three people present fell dying. You're right. I can't see a path that doesn't lead to death. Let's revise our circumstances and see if any more options open to us in a minute or two.
Good,
Lumaya said.
Now, Vergere, a Jedi, but one who is quietly resentful of the hidebound ways of the old Jedi Council. Its resistance to any learning outside the rote procedures that had been a part of the Order for so long. She was a rogue student of the Force, of techniques and pathways that are not all part of the Jedi school. You agree?
Jason nodded.
In her investigations, she studies Count Dooku, and his trail leads her to Darth Sidious, who has just taken Dooku as apprentice. Darth Sidious, who the galaxy learns decades later, is Palpatine. Sidious accepts her as a student and candidate. Vergere learns from Palpatine, and she learns about him. She observes. She sees his weakness, his greed, his compulsion to rule and manipulate. She realizes that he could be the most destructive living force in the galaxy, and she decides to kill him. But Vergere strikes too soon. Palpatine survives and puts killers on her trail. She uses Jedi Order resources to keep her a step ahead of her pursuers, and soon accepts a Jedi mission that may get her clear of her enemies. It takes her to the world of Sonama Seacot, and from there she chooses to leave with the mission that eventually reaches the galaxy of the Yuuzhan Vong.
That doesn't make her Sith, Jason said. Lumaya's tone turned chiding.
Think about it, Jason. She cared for you, cared for the fate of the galaxy, cared for everyone. She gave Mara Jade the healing treatment that allowed her to carry that boy. She was a Sith, and yet she helped give Luke Skywalker a son. She could be cruelly ruthless, couldn't she? And yet each act of ruthlessness improved matters, improved her surroundings, improved you.
Nalani gave Jason one more look, and in her glance there was worry and anguish.
That's it, she said.
She struck at Lumaya, but the older woman twirled to one side. Nalani advanced. Lumaya retreated, slapping her thigh, digging her fingers through the cloth and into her thigh. She yanked, and suddenly in her hands was a whip. She flicked it back, preparatory to striking with it. Its tendrils, for there were several instead of just one, spread out into something that moved like a weaponized cloud, some of them shining iron-like and jagged, some of them glowing like a lightsaber's blade.
Let Lumaya talk, Jason said.
Can't you feel yourself wavering?
There was a shrill tone of desperation in Nalani's voice.
She's bending your mind.
bending your will.
Jason shook his head. No, she's not. If I'm wavering, it's before a presentation of fact, not mind tricks. Come on, Nalani. If mind tricks were involved, don't you think you'd feel them?
Vergère sacrificed herself so you could assume the Sith mantle she wanted for you,
Lumaya continued.
That's the kind of self-sacrifice no Jedi would admit is possible for the Sith. But it's the truth. Take what I have to teach you, Jason. Take this place and the dark side power it contains. Take the knowledge that rests in its tombs on the world of Zyost and use them against the forces that are trying to tear this galaxy apart. Restore order. Give your cousin, give the children in your family and your life the chance to grow up in a galaxy without war.
You're still withholding the truth, Jason said. You killed the security chief on Toriyaz Station, didn't you?
Yes,
she said.
Of course. I caught up to him too late to prevent the attack on you. It was already underway. But I could force from him an admission of who he was working for and avenge the dead.
Who was he working for?
Thraken Sal Solo. Who else?
How about your confederate? Jason asked. The man Master Skywalker keeps glimpsing but can't quite see. The man he says doesn't exist. Lumaya managed a laugh that was half-exhausted gasp.
Jason, that's you. Visions of you. The Sith you will become. Luke can't make out his features because he's not willing to accept what he sees through the Force. Your face where the next Lord of the Sith stands.
Nalani leapt forward, slashing at her enemy. Her blade came down on Jason's. His blade held hers. His eyes held her eyes. I'm not through here, he said. There was despair in Nalani's voice.
I don't know how, but she's turning you. Can't you see it?
Stop listening with just your ears, Jason said. Look into the Force. Do you really see any flow from her to me? From me to her? Something that could alter my mind or my perceptions?
Nalani held his gaze for a moment more, then closed her eyes. Finally, Nalani's eyes opened again, and she seemed calmer.
No,
she admitted.
Lumaya isn't using any Force techniques against you. You're not being influenced by the dark side energies here. I don't understand what's happening.
Turn off your lightsaber, Jason said. She did. He turned his own off. Now the only sound of menace came from Lumaya's light whip. The older woman looked at the weapon, and the glowing tendrils faded to darkness, to almost invisible threads.
There, Jason said. Now we can work things out.
Yes.
Nalani turned toward Lumaya.
Shira Bree, I arrest you in the name of the Galactic Alliance. You will be tried for...
No, Jason said. I've decided to learn what she has to teach me. That means she needs to remain free, to remain here.
Nalani looked at him, disbelieving.
Jason, the law...
The law is what we make of it. He shrugged. She has said she's Lumaya, Nalani, but she hasn't proven it. All we have to do is not believe her, to leave that claim out of our reports, and we've followed the letter of the law. Nalani moved slightly, stepping back, bringing the hilt of her lightsaber a few centimeters up.
I am arresting her,
Lumaya interrupted.
I'll consent to be arrested.
Both of the Jedi looked at her. You will? Jason asked.
Of course.
Lumaya looked sober, unhappy.
I know my fate is no longer my own. I want to see the Sith rise with you at the head of the Order, Jason. And for that reason, I swear myself to your service.
She knelt as she spoke, lowering her head. An invitation for a blessing, or for a killing stroke.
But whichever one of you is in charge here will choose my fate, my future.
Her voice low, Nalani said, Put your hands behind your back. As Lumaya obeyed, Nalani pulled a pair of stun cuffs from her belt pouch. Jason frowned. There was something wrong about this situation, and for a moment, he suspected treachery on Lumaya's part. But a glimpse into the likely immediate future dispelled that notion. He saw Lumaya obedient, unresisting, being led back to the shuttle. His mind flickered forward through the likely time streams. The future, as Yoda had said so frequently and famously, that the quotation littered the Jedi archives, was always in motion, and many potential futures led from this event. But they began congregating in certain areas, Nalani testifying against Shira Bree, also known as Lumaya, also known as Brisha Sayo, Lumaya convicted, being executed, being locked up in solitude, being locked up in a mass prison and assassinated by someone whose father she had killed decades ago. All she knew vanishing, dying with her. Along all these paths, the galaxy continued to come unhinged, rebellion sparking in all corners, the Galactic Alliance crumbling like a cancer-racked body, eating itself from the inside out, whole populations dying. Detonators destroying this place, blowing the asteroid into millions of pieces, scattering the knowledge hidden here. An ancient star destroyer raining turbo laser destruction down on the surface of Xyost, purging it of knowledge lingering there. Scores of timelines congregated on Jason Solo and Luke Skywalker, bringing them together. The two of them faced each other, their surroundings changing every second as the scene slipped from timeline to timeline, yet their poses and lightsabers lit in their hands remained the same, as did the anger and tragic loss twisting both their faces. They spun, they struck, the impacts of their lightsabers causing flares of light to cast the walls and floors behind them into greater darkness. On and on they fought, their loss giving them strength, until Jason cut Luke down. Luke died. Luke died. No, Jason whispered. He summoned himself back to the here and now. Nalani and Lumaya were walking away. The younger woman held the older by the shoulder, guiding her. Jason lit his lightsaber and struck. Nalani jumped away, but the glowing blade merely parted the cuffs that held Lumaya's hands together behind her back. Both women looked at him. She remains free, Jason told Nalani. If you take her... He could not say the rest of the words. Luke dies, and I kill him. There was more to it than that. For a moment, he was drawn back into the streams of probability that led him into the future. Nalani could leave without her prisoner. She would return home to Lord and tell all to her superiors, to Luke. Jason cut Luke down. Luke died. Nalani could be persuaded not to tell. She would rethink her promise later and break it, telling all to Luke. Jason cut Luke down. Luke died. Only in the time streams where Nalani fell, never to rise, did Luke remain on his feet, in command, alive. Other tragedies, shadowy and indistinct, swirled around him, but he lived. Jason returned again to the present. The truth of what he had just experienced through the Force numbed him. But it was the truth, and he had to be strong enough to face it. Lumaya knew it, or had some sense of it. There were tears on her cheeks to match the ones he felt on his own.
There is this about being Sith, she told him. We strengthen ourselves through sacrifice.
Jason nodded, grudging acceptance of that fact. Yes. Nalani looked at him, and beyond him, into his intent. With a noise that was half moan, she turned and fled. Jason raced after her. Nalani ran with the speed of a trained athlete, but as soon as she passed beyond the cavern where Darth Vectivus's house stood and where the artificial gravity generator operated, her gait became inefficient, her leaps too long. She didn't have Jason's experience with low gravity. He began to catch up to her. She bounded along the rails toward the surface habitat, her lightsaber giving her enough light to see the cross rungs where she needed to place her feet. The rails rose through a gap in the cavern ceiling, and beyond that point, Jason could no longer see Nalani. He left his own lightsaber on, but closed his eyes, seeking her with his Force senses. And there she was, hurtling toward him in the leg-forward posture of a vicious sidekick. Not looking in her direction, he twisted aside and swatted at her with his lightsaber. He put no strength behind his blow. He didn't need to. The blade caught her on the inner thigh, slicing through the cloth and skin and muscle. She shrieked, flew past him, hit the stony surface of this cavern floor, and rolled, in the curious way that low gravity mandated, to a halt. When he reached her, she was sitting, unable to stand, her now lit lightsaber in her right hand, her right leg now useless beneath her.
"Jason, don't do this," she said.
"You don't understand what's at stake."
I'm not concerned with living or dying, she told him. I surrendered my fate to the Force when I joined the Order. It's you. If you do this, you'll become something bad. Something destructive.
A Sith.
No. Call it whatever you want to. What do you call someone who kills without needing to? Someone who joins sides with evil because of a well-reasoned argument?
He stood there and looked at her, and was battered by emotions. His, hers, lingering dark side energies from thousands of years before. A deep sorrow settled across him. Sorrow at the tragedy being perpetrated. In Nalani's myriad futures, he could dimly glimpse good and kind acts, love, perhaps family and children. He was about to cut through the connective tissues between Nalani and those futures. And he could feel the pain of that cut. In a way, the sensation was almost comforting, reminding him that he was still possessed of human emotion, of human values. Nalani, he said, I'm sorry. You're a deflector that would send the future spinning into tragedy. And you're too young, too weak to understand it, to correct it.
Jason!
He struck, a slash that turned into a twirl, binding her blade. The maneuver disarmed her, leaving her arm untouched but spinning her lightsaber off into the darkness. He struck again, a surgical thrust that entered the precise center of her breastbone, emerged from her spine. Jason pulled the lightsaber free. Nalani slumped to the side, and he felt her begin to vanish into the Force. Until she finished her slow fall, and her head lolled against the stone, her eyes did not leave his.
Corellian space above Tralis.
Leia watched the status boards as they provided updates on the situation at Reladir. Headquarters shields down, headquarters destroyed. Tralis citizens spilling into the streets, sniping on GA ground occupation forces with hand blasters, hunting blasters. Corellian capital ships and hyperdrive-equipped starfighters dropping out of hyperspace on the far side of Tralis, joining the furball in the skies above Reladir, swelling its numbers even as the GA retaliated with more and more starfighter squadron launches. Covert messages from Han relayed in tight burst data packets. Those messages reported Han alive, Jaina alive, Wedge alive, the Antilles girl alive. Withdrawal command from Dodona. The GA squadrons obeyed, disengaging where and when they could, some of them staying behind for last-minute exchanges with the gloating Corellians. Leia was called back to the bridge, where she rejoined Admiral Impan on the walkway. Together, they watched Dodona's complement of surviving starfighters line up for landings in the ship's hangar bays.
We could have held on here, Admiral Impan said, by throwing more and more forces into the mix, and yet that would have been counterproductive, making peace harder to achieve.
We didn't.
We won't. But that makes this conclusion a scripted one. The men and women who died, young and brave, did so for a predestined conclusion.
Leia nodded in silent agreement.
It feels not like a victory, or even like a loss. It feels like dancing to someone else's tune.
The GA isn't playing it, Leia said.
Nor the Corellians,
the Admiral shrugged.
Will you be returning to Coruscant or Corellia?
Corellia for now.
I'll arrange for a starfighter escort for your shuttle. May the Force be with you, Princess.
And also with you, Admiral.
Star system MZX-32905 near Bemeel.
You'll give her appropriate rights? Jason asked. Lumaya nodded.
She was a noble warrior. I will treat her as such.
They stood together in the large airlock adjacent to the hangar bay where Jason's shuttle waited. The docking tube was pressurized and coupled to the shuttle's side. Ben, unconscious, was aboard, strapped onto a seat with his lightsaber once again hooked to his belt.
I know this was hurtful, Lumaya said, but you have been strengthened by it already.
Jason, pained, looked at her. Words, Lumaya. He will strengthen himself through pain. They don't diminish the tragedy of what just happened. Not at all.
It's not a cliche, Jason. It's a necessary component of the ethical assumption of our powers.
The Jedi find their balance through the abandonment of attachment. The Sith celebrate attachment, but find our balance in the deliberate agonizing sacrifice of some of the things we love most. Only by that means can we retain our appreciation for loss, pain, mortality, those things that ordinary people experience. You will be the man your grandfather couldn't. Go home, do what you can to stop the war, and to free up time to study. Eventually, you will need to find yourself an apprentice. Ben may be worthy, but I think he is already too steeped in the Jedi ways of softness and serenity. So look elsewhere, as well as at him. You'll need to train to open your mind to facets of the Force you've been instructed to ignore or despise. And your greatest attainment of knowledge and power will come at the same time as your greatest act of sacrifice, when you give up something that is as dear to you as life, making your love immortal through its sacrifice.
We'll see, he said.
Come back, and I will help you see.
She stood watching through the airlock's transparasteel wall as he boarded, sealed his shuttle, uncoupled the boarding tube. The shuttle rose on its repulsors, gently turned toward the opening doors, and departed. Tired, drained, jubilant, Lumaya returned to the living chamber at the top of her habitat. She lay on a couch there and stared up through the scratched transparasteel dome at the stars.
I've won, she said.
Jason, dark garbed, a gold and black lightsaber hilt at his belt, the pupils of his eyes golden orange, moved out from a shadowy nook and turned to face her. His mouth did not move, but his words carried to Lumaya's mind.
And so I must go, become nothingness.
You always were nothingness. You're a projection, dark side energy from the caverns, shaped by my imagination and Jason Solo's form. But you'll be back, bit by bit. Jason Solo will become you.
And at last, I'll have a name, a Sith name.
Coruscant.
He exists.
Luke looked up from his terminal. On its screen scrolled updated reports of the engagement at Tralis, but Mara could feel that the worry on his face was caused by something else.
He finally exists for real. Your phantom enemy? Yes.
Luke rose.
That must have been why we were attacked tonight.
The false Jason, the false Ben. They occupied our emotions so thoroughly that we missed the creation of
whatever he is, wherever he is. Maybe it happened close by, or there would have been no reason to divert us.
He looked in all directions, as though the smooth stone walls of the Enclave interior chamber would become transparent and reveal the enemy. But they remained stubbornly opaque. We'll find him, Mara said, and we'll beat him. Her attention returned to her own terminal, and a smile crossed her features.
Message from Jason and Ben. They're coming home.
This is Mark Thompson. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Star Wars Legacy of the Force Betrayal by Aaron Alston. This program was produced, directed, and abridged by Kevin Thompson, executive producer Jacob Bronstein. Star Wars Legacy of the Force Betrayal is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 2006. All rights reserved, used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2006, Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.